from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The passage goes from Stettin in the Baltic, so that means up in the north of Europe, to Trieste in the Adriatic, on the southern border. An iron curtain has fallen. And behind that, he goes on to characterize, there's a police state. People are suppressed in their speech. Their property is taken.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Larry Arn, our first guest on today's program. Dr. Arn is president at Hillsdale College. We talked at length about the 75th anniversary of Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech. Dr. Arn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for your great work, Scott.
We just recently celebrated the 75th anniversary of Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, March 5th of 1946, and want to talk a bit about that today. Give us a little bit of context as to the run-up to that address in 1946. World War II, of course, had ended. Yalta was about a year prior to that, in February of 1945. What's the environment leading up to this speech by Winston Churchill?
Well, it all happened very fast. I mean, after the Second World War, the greatest injury the world has ever suffered, man-made, after that was over, the world was in collapse. Europe was in collapse. The nations not in collapse were the Soviet Union and the United States. And the Soviet Union was threatened to take all of Europe. And then in early July, there were two things going on at the same time, and one is the Potsdam Conference, the last conference of the Second World War of the great powers, which failed, by the way, to reach an agreement to bring peace, was underway. Churchill went to the first half of it as prime minister, and then he went home on about July 5th, and it was announced that he'd been swept by the socialists. So he'd been resisting that all his life, and so he had also warned all his life that these major wars are going to come and they will destroy us. We have to find a way to prevent them. In 1945, he had failed on both those points. His glory was they won the war, mm-hmm. and it had a lot to do with him. But to fight it at all, he thought, was terrible. And now these socialists are in. And he had become the greatest man in the world. He was treated like that by everybody, his enemies too. And the election, by every evidence we have, was not a repudiation of him, but of his party, an adoption of a wild new thing to make the world better. We got that going on in our society right now. So he went away for 3 weeks and licked his wounds, took his daughter. She cheered him up, one of his daughters. He had three. And so that's end of July now. He goes back. He announces his plan to fight the socialists and says he's not going to retire. And he did follow that plan. It's relevant today. He said, you know, these things we've been warning about, now they're going to do these things, and people will see them better, and we can capitalize on that. We can point them out. And that's how he won the 1951 election.
So how does this speech, which becomes the Iron Curtain moment, as we would remember it, how does that speech come about during this time?
From the doldrums, then sometime in September, and I forget the date, he gets a letter from the president of Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the name of the president, and I should, but college presidents are not really important. And at the bottom, come and talk, he says. And at the bottom, there's a P.S. written in the hand of Harry Truman. And it says, this is a nice little college in my home state. Please come. I will introduce you. And that's a very significant thing. You know, the most powerful man in the world is going to put this guy, just beaten in an election, on the stage. And it's very important that Churchill had lost the election,
mm-hmm.
because now he could come as the greatest man in the world, and he's not speaking for a government, not ours, not the British. He had the permission and the support of the socialist cabinet, which was very anti-communist. Thank God for it. So anyway, American policy was going through one of its greatest revolutions in our long history. Because what we were doing, what Truman did, basically between August and the following February, is he reversed American foreign policy to focus on containment of the Soviet Union. And we had indulged them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
During the war, We had not taken territory we could have taken in Europe and let them have it. And, you know, the Potsdam Conference was over about July the 9th, and 2 weeks later, they were arresting people that they had promised to liberate, and they were, and everybody is turning, right? And there's a sort of finger pointing going on. But the, Truman was new. He came into presidency in April, I think, when Roosevelt died. And the point was he was thinking fast, and he had this idea. It was a germ when he wrote to Churchill, as far as we know, that I'll let him make a grand statement with me there. And that's how it came to be. It was a very important thing. It happened in March the 5th, 1946. Everybody's aware, I mean, everybody in the know about it knows this is going to be a big deal.
Hmm. Talking with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College and Churchill expert on the Iron Curtain speech by Winston Churchill. We've got to the day of the event, Dr. Arnn. Take us through what's happening on the day of this Iron Curtain speech.
He went to Washington the day before, and he spent the afternoon with Truman, and he rode on the train with him down from Washington to Fulton, Missouri. And they talked the whole time. And Churchill sent a cable to the cabinet back home saying he's read the speech and he heartily approves. But Truman told a fib about that later, said he hadn't read it, but didn't speak for me. And the beginning of the speech, there's a wonderful photograph of it. Churchill's standing there, and his first words are, something about a joke about Westminster. I know about that place because he worked in it. It's where the Parliament is. And then he says, I'm a private citizen. There is nothing here but what you see. Well, that photograph shows what you saw. It was Winston Churchill standing at the podium and Harry Truman immediately to his right. And so that's a great thing. And it means that Truman was able to make an international statement and yet not be immediately responsible for it.
So the speech itself, that phrase, the Iron Curtain, is that a Churchill phrase? Did he develop that himself? Did he borrow it from elsewhere? And then for people who perhaps are just not familiar, tell us what he was describing when he talked about his Iron Curtain.
Well, he invented it. He'd used it twice before in correspondence. Yeah, the passage goes from Stettin in the Baltic, so that means up in the north of Europe, to Trieste in the Adriatic, so on the southern border. An Iron Curtain has fallen. And behind that, he goes on to characterize, there's a police state. People are suppressed in their speech. Their property is taken. The courts are not operating properly. And it's tyranny. And he describes that. And you know, it's that passage is, you know, Winston Churchill was very good at describing things, and it's very strong. It actually isn't the heart of the speech. He called the speech the sinews of peace. And he spends the whole speech describing what they are. And it's one of his most beautiful speeches, and it's intricate. Because he starts with a bunch of universal propositions, and then he qualifies them down to a specific policy at the end. And the universal proposition is, we have to secure the safety and welfare, the comfort and prosperity, something like that, of every home in every village in every land. That means everybody, right? And then he talks about the United Nations as a great hope. But after he lays all that out, then come the qualifications, and there are many. The first one to come is, it would be criminal madness to let loose the secret of the nuclear bomb in this divided world. It's safe because of who has it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Britain and the United States and Canada. If the Soviets had it, it would be a very different story. So the United Nations is going to have an army. It's not going to have the strongest weapon.
Dr. Arnn, let's pause right there. We'll come back in a moment and talk further about the Iron Curtain speech by Winston Churchill. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College and noted Churchill expert, about the 75th anniversary of the Iron Curtain speech by Winston Churchill. We are discussing the speech itself at this point. Dr. Arn, what else did Churchill say in this speech?
It is not our duty, he says, to interfere in countries that we have not conquered in war. Well, that writes off the whole of Eastern Europe. Not our duty to do it. Might be our interest, that's a different question. And so he's not going to go intervene everywhere. But, he says, we must never cease to proclaim in fearless tones the great themes of liberty, now I'm paraphrasing, that occur above all in the American Declaration of Independence, which, in, by the way, Winston Churchill, he talks about the Declaration of Independence all through his career. He loves it. And it is not the source of disunion of Britain. As he interprets it, that's our unity.
Mm-hmm.
Because he loved to say, the Declaration of Independence grew up on the banks of the Thames River, where London is, the Parliament. So he says, so that now we're getting close to the heart of it, right? The nations that stand for freedom. And it's an interesting thing to Churchill that those are mostly English-speaking nations, and that means they can talk to each other. And, you know, we have two ways of ruling or dealing with each other. We can talk or we can use force. And talking is better. And so he always believed that was a very significant fact all over the world, that huge numbers of people spoke English, and they had learned these principles in the beautiful language in which they were written. So then he comes to his final point, which is just awesome. He says, now I come to the crux. That's a word derived from the word for cross, right, in French and Latin. And that means the place where all the points meet. What I've traveled here to say, the British Empire and the United States of America must have a special relationship, one of the great phrases from the speech, and that if we work together, that can be the greatest force for good in the world. And what he was doing, he then proceeded to do for the rest of his life, and he was in power for 3.5 more years, in 51 to 55, he sort of offered the British Empire as a facility. We can have it. You know, we'll keep it. You're not any good at this.
Dr. Arn, when Churchill says the British Empire, what does he really mean by that?
There are two facts about it. The first is, if you just look at a map of it, it's amazing. It's a coastal empire.
Mm-hmm.
It goes into Africa some. It goes across Canada. There's a little bit in South America. But what it really does is ring the Eurasian landmass, where, by the way, right now, 75% of the world's people live. And that's a naval power kind of empire. Handy to have. We got problems with China today. If you read Winston Churchill, the first thing you'll think about is Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, and Japan. And we should be solidifying our links with them in every way that we can. Then the second thing about it is, and it was very hard, Americans, both the Roosevelt and the Truman administration, had trouble understanding this point. Britain's power in the two world wars was expanded in numbers of soldiers and contributions by about 45% by the imperial nations. And Britain was not in a position to command or conscript any soldier from any of those nations. The nations had to send them voluntarily. They were self-governing. There's a great episode, one of my favorites. In 1943, they're getting North Africa conquered. It looks like they're going to win. And so Peter Fraser, who was the Prime Minister of New Zealand, writes to Churchill and says, congratulations on our wonderful victory. We've got the Japanese looming. We've got four divisions in our army, and you've got one of them, the best. We need it back. And all he had to do was send a cable to the general, and the general would have come home. He wrote Churchill. Churchill writes him back and pleads with him. It's a very beautiful letter, and he says, the heart of the decision will be taken here in Europe. We can protect, you can protect, you and we can protect you from the Japanese and hold the line while we stay here and fight it out. And so Fraser writes him again in a week and says, well, we've had a cabinet discussion and a full day's debate in our House of Commons over this proposal of yours, and the troops may stay. Now see, they're in danger themselves on the other side of the world, and they have the option to bring them home,
mm-hmm.
but they don't, and that means that Churchill was correct about something. This is an empire of sentiment and love, right? And he offered that to us. And, you know, some of it, India was not yet independent, and Churchill was against their independence only until it would result in war if they were giving it. It wouldn't anymore result in war, because India, I mean, they still have untouchability in India, and they're divided. India at that time included what is now Pakistan,
mm-hmm.
and the Hindus and the Muslims didn't like each other. So Churchill didn't want to go, but the Indian army was an all-volunteer army. And that meant nobody was conscripted, and they had, in the First World War, 2 million men fighting in Europe. 2 million, right? As many as we had. So Churchill was right about that thing, and he thought that and he thought then that it's an empire united under the principles of the Declaration of Independence, which becomes the principle, you know, the first great severing of anything from the British Empire becomes the principle of holding it together.
Hmm.
He says that explicitly on July the 4th, 1918, at the end of the First World War. It's the source. By the Declaration of Independence, we lost an empire, but by learning its lessons, we have preserved an empire. And Churchill, when he got to Fulton, Missouri in 1946, he'd been working out those themes all his life. And he was ready to give that speech.
Let me ask briefly about the consequences, the fallout from the speech. Was it apparent immediately that it was going to be a speech of consequence? Did it help to persuade others to see this threat of Soviet communism in the same way that Churchill did? What happened after the speech?
Oh, just it was a firestorm. Of course, the very reliable New York Times attacked the speech. Much of the American press did. Joe Stalin himself attacked it. Truman and the Attlee socialist government in London both said, well, it wasn't our speech. But then Truman began a series of actions. You know, he had just sent, when the speech was given, he had just sent a major naval flotilla to Istanbul to deliver home the body of the dead Turkish ambassador from D.C., a show of force in a place where the Soviet Union is putting pressure. And then soon after that, it's the Marshall Plan, which is relief money for Europe. And then soon after that, well, at that same time, it's the Truman Doctrine, which is we're going to contain the communists. And so, and this speech can say, you know, it marks the beginning of the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
effectively, the alternative to the Cold War being Soviet domination of all Europe.
Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College, talking as we just celebrate the 75th anniversary of Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, March 5th of 1946. Dr. Arn, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Up next, we talk with Mary Eberstadt about what might really be behind the violent riots the U.S. has experienced over the past year or so. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Hey guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Hi, this is Cindy at Lauk's Landscape Supply at the corner of Dersh Airport and Churn Creek Road. As we grow our landscape lineup, we invite you to come see what we have done to bring you a high-quality selection for all your projects. Take advantage of our ever-growing selection of small rental equipment to help transform your yard, like a track machine trencher, rototillers, sod cutters, fiber plates, sod rollers, and so much more. Get the lawn you want this year using our Bolero Plus Sod by Delta Bluegrass and pair that with our Jumpstart Fertilizer to give it the boost it needs to thrive. Lauk's Landscape Supply is home of the U-Car Concrete, where we have a large fleet of concrete trailers to help get the job done right and on time. Call and reserve yours today at 378-2220. You pick up or we deliver, where no load is too big or too small. At Lauk's Landscape Supply, we have several different size trucks to accommodate your needs with fast and efficient delivery to your job site. We have a dedicated staff ready to walk you through your next project, so just give us a call at 378-2220. Check us out on the web at laukslandscapesupply.com or just come see us 7 days a week at the intersection of Dersh Airport and Churn Creek Road, and tell your friends.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can find us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Mary Eberstadt. She's a senior fellow at Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. Her most recent book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. You can also find her writing at maryeberstadt.com. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Wanted to discuss with you today a very interesting essay you wrote for First Things a little bit back, titled The Fury of the Fatherless, and looking deeply at these violent protests in many areas of the country and what might be causing them, or at least the calculus as to what is going into them. You write early in this piece, Mary, that a critical mass of humanity has become socially dysfunctional on a scale not seen before. What are the overarching reasons that you identify for that happening?
For a couple of decades now, psychiatrists and other mental health professionals have been tracking the rise of anxiety, depression, and other psychological problems, especially among young people. And the professionals all agree that they are seeing a steep rise in issues like this. So if you put those two facts together, the riots and protests on a scale we haven't seen and the increase in mental disorders among the young, I think what we are seeing is a social unraveling that is due to the fact that people are increasingly unmoored from their primal connections. And what are those connections? Connections to their immediate communities, including religious communities. We know that young people are increasingly disconnected from those. We've seen a steep rise in people who profess no religious affiliation. And also, equally primal, is the disconnection from family. So in that piece, The Fury of the Fatherless, what I argue is that this background of disorder and disconnection is the real context for for the protests and the riots. Of course, the issue of police brutality was what sparked the protests in the first place. But as summer went on, it became harder and harder to believe that that was the sole source of the discontent we were seeing in the streets.
Mary, you write that this fatherlessness naturally leads to a search for a father substitute, something to take the place of the father. Where are some of these protesters instead finding the father figure?
Well, I think, Scott, that this is what's guiding the need to join these identitarian communities. That is, people will try and find authority figures, including people who think that they're free from all authority. They're not. They will find a substitute for the father they don't have, the church they don't have. And increasingly, we're seeing this in the fanatical attachment that people have to identity groups, who, you know, based on my sexual identity or my political identity, my feminist identity, whatever it may be. These groups are operating as quasi-churches and quasi-families for people who are increasingly detached from the real thing. And that's why we see this loyalty that seems so misplaced in politics. This is what cancel culture is all about, Scott. It's about taking that primal loyalty that people feel toward the family and putting it onto a political entity such that if you cross that entity, if you utter the wrong words, if you don't use the right pronouns, you are cast out the way people might cast out someone who transgressed a member of their family. So we're seeing this, I think, unprecedented shift of these emotions attached to primordial things, and they're now being attached instead to political groups. This is where the real divisiveness in our politics comes from. Everybody talks about it, but most people don't want to go to the root cause of why it is that there's so much aggression and cancel culture in our political realm.
Talking,
this, I think, is the origin of it.
You describe what you call a people deficit among the youth in this country. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the demographic changes since the 1960s have had the effect of subtracting people from people's lives. And let me lay out just some of those trends. You have, for example, widespread abortion, which has, in effect, removed children from mothers and fathers, removed siblings from people who might otherwise have had them. You have the shrinking of the family. A lot of kids are growing up as only children or maybe one of two children. And with that shrinkage goes the shrinkage of the extended family, so that people are growing up without robust networks of cousins, uncles, aunts, etc. So, again, this is a matter of simple arithmetic. There are fewer and fewer people in our lives, especially if we are young, from whom we can learn elemental things. And I think, Scott, that this, too, is part of the problem out there.
Mary Eberstadt with us. Find her writings at maryeberstadt.com. She's here with us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. For many years, you mentioned the decline of American patriotism among the young has been charted in surveys. Is that just another community, I mean, the community of the nation that young people feel they are not a part of?
Yes, it's interesting, Scott, and sad to contemplate, but one of the things I was trying to get at in that essay, The Fury of the Fatherless, is the possibility that we are witnessing something genuinely new under the sun, the possibility that the loss of the literal father in so many homes, combined with the loss of the figurative father, the God the Father, is also making it hard for people to attach to any other kind of authority, including love of country. So what I'm speculating about is that the loss of patriotism that is becoming increasingly evident among the young might be connected to the fact that they were not able to attach as generations before did, to a father in the home or a father, God the Father in the church, that maybe this kind of attachment to paternal authority of some kind is like a muscle, and the less it is exercised, the weaker it gets. And that maybe, just maybe, this is what we're seeing in the decline of patriotism.
One final question for Mary Eberstadt. If we, in fact, have reached some sort of critical mass of the maladjusted, the disenfranchised that we've discussed, what can we do to help these people?
Well, again, it's like any diagnosis. If you get the diagnosis wrong, you can't fix the problem. And so my hope is that the churches, for example, can step up. If people realize that what we've got is a father problem, the churches are well equipped to help with that. The churches at their best have good male role models out there who can step in and be that substitute father instead of letting the internet do it. So there's room for that. There's also a lot of room for the power of example. We see people brought in to religion, for instance, out of this broken world that so many grow up in, and they're brought in because they see an affirmative vision there. They see a positive idea of the human person. So I think there's a lot of room for hope, but it has to begin with recognizing and in some way honoring the fact that we see that suffering out there. We see where people are coming from, and we're trying to get them to own up to that suffering at its primal level and not just become, you know, members of these political collectives that really don't solve problems.
Mary Eberstadt, Senior Fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in D.C. You can find her writing at maryeberstadt.com and also this piece at firstthings.com, The Fury of the Fatherless. Mary, thank you so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Dr. Ethan Stoneman from Hillsdale's Rhetoric and Public Address Department on the societal impact of true crime documentaries. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's the Ramsey Show, where we talk about your life and your money. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and hear us online at KCNR1460.com. Don't miss Armstrong and Getty, plus Ben Shapiro, and Free Fire Radio with Carl and Linda Bott, featuring special guests talking about local issues on KCNR.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuente's Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper, and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at EstateGranite.com.
Hey, Redding, guess what? Our dining room at Black Bear Diner is open again, and we're bringing chili back. That's right. Come dine in comfort inside of our Hilltop Drive location. And special for March, ask for a bowl or cup of our delicious homemade chili, or try one of our new chili creations, a chili stuffed breakfast burrito, a chili cheddar cheeseburger, or for dinner, our tri-tip chili platter. Come dine inside or order for takeout at blackbeardiner.com.
Black Bear Diner.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of this program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Ethan Stoneman, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Public Address here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Stoneman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Talking today about a very interesting research paper that you wrote, the title, Real Cruelty, Voyeurism and Extrajuridical Punishment in True Crime Documentaries. How do you define true crime documentaries? Are we talking about, you know, feature films, the TV shows, the Dateline NBC specials?
Right. Well, you know, the term documentary, there are definitions. People sometimes quarrel over them. But really the first, I guess, definition that people still use comes from the 1930s by this British guy named John Grierson. He didn't actually direct documentaries, but he was more the head of a collaborative team. But he defined documentary as the creative treatment of actuality. And I think that's the basis of what is still our probably common sense idea about documentary, which is documentaries are movies about reality, right? They're about something that actually happened. They document real events, right? They don't use professional actors. And to the extent that a documentary tells a story, you know, the story aims to be a plausible representation of what happened rather than an imaginative interpretation or referring to reality through allegory or of other indirect means. So that's a documentary. True crime is a genre that actually cuts across different media. So we can have films, we can have books, podcasts are actually maybe the most popular medium for true crime right now, but TV shows, and they center around actual crimes, actual criminal investigations, oftentimes they're ongoing cases. Almost half of them focus on serial killers. If you go to Netflix right now, there are docuseries on Henry Lee Lucas and Ted Bundy. The new one, I think, is Richard Ramirez, The Night Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
You also have high-profile, sensational crimes like JonBenet Ramsey, O.J. Simpson, Amanda Knox. But you also have ones that are devoted to more obscure slayings, like Making a Murderer, also on Netflix. And so true crime documentaries would be true crime documentaries. So we're talking about feature-length films. It would exclude technically docuseries like Making a Murderer because it's episodic.
I mean, what's the potential harm here in these true crime documentaries? What's wrong, or at least potentially wrong, with what's being presented here?
There are a lot of standard lines of criticism against true crime, and they go back some time now. I think maybe the most common one is that when we're talking about high-profile sensationalistic stories, I think there's a potential to glorify awful, violent, deviant behavior, turning murderers, rapists, etc., into celebrities. Certainly we saw that beginning with Charles Manson, but also, you know, even bank robbers like, you know, Dillinger. So that's one criticism. And the paper idea actually began with the sort of that controversy when it reemerged with the Ted Bundy tapes, which mm-hmm. is a docuseries on Netflix, because it also was paired with a fictionalized narrative film about Bundy.
Right.
And I forget the actor they used, but, you know, some young, attractive guy. And so this concern of, oh, well, we're glorifying, we're sexualizing this mass murderer. But that's one, I think, concern. There are others too, and I think for us the more significant one is the potential for these stories to create or exacerbate trauma,
mm-hmm.
right? That there's a potential for true crime, anything, right? Stories to interfere in real criminal cases, but also real people's lives.
Talking with Dr. Ethan Stoneman, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Public Address at Hillsdale. Real Cruelty is the name of his research paper, Voyeurism and Extrajudicial Punishment in True Crime Documentaries. paper argues the design of certain documentaries constitutes an exercise of extrajuridical punitive power. So what does that mean?
Yeah, sorry for that phrase. So basically, you have a lot of people that defend true crime, and you have a lot of critics of true crime. But one thing they both agree on is that if trauma is a result of a true crime medium, right, or story, that trauma is an unwanted and unintentional byproduct of any true crime artifact. But that's not what it's supposed to do. And my co-author Joe Packer and I argue that, well, in fact, trauma or inflicting suffering can, in fact, be a design. It can be a feature and not a bug. And that we actually do have instances where we could look at a film, a documentary, and say it's designed to inflict trauma on persons who are suspected of wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
And in those instances, I think true crime documentaries don't just seek to rectify, say, a discrete failure in the legal system, but they actually themselves are a means of pursuing retributive justice, right? Where punishment is inflicted on someone as vengeance, right, for a wrong or a criminal act, but it takes place outside the law. So mm-hmm. that's the extra legal or extra juridical form or aspect of this kind of vengeance.
So is it a problem, should we consider it a problem, that viewers of some of these true crime documentaries are enjoying themselves, are deriving some kind of pleasure from an exercise of watching these documentaries?
I don't really want to make any blanket moral judgments, right? But, and I do think there are many ways that people could derive pleasure from true crime, whether they're reading about it or watching it or listening to it. In terms of deriving pleasure or satisfaction from retribution or vengeance, I understand that impulse. I do. I don't think anybody wants to see evil gone unpunished, but that's not the same thing as getting a sense of pleasure out of watching that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a Christian and a humanist, I want to say, no, I think it's distasteful to take pleasure in someone else's suffering, even if you think it's deserved. On the other hand, I do think true crime reinforces basic societal norms of right and wrong, which is good. And I think it can reassure us that we do live in a moral universe where crimes don't go unpunished, wrongs are righted. I think I'm maybe a little bit more ambivalent about that one because that's not really the world we live in, or doesn't seem to be at some time. And I think there's also the issue that true crime may gloss over problems in a legal system, right? That these are just discrete errors that we can solve with gumption or individual action, but I think that's a separate issue. But if I have to just give an answer, yeah, I don't think it's right to derive pleasure from true crime in that way.
Is there a correction course that is needed? Is it enough that perhaps viewers are a little bit more aware of what's happening and the potential consequences of these episodes or these documentaries?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the benefits of critically examining media, is that you become more aware of all of the different types of stories and messages that you are consuming. I think that typically we look at even something like documentary, but also narrative film and television and podcasts, we tend to view these things as escapist and as a passive form of entertainment. But I think it's always a good idea to try and step back and have a kind of critical detachment so that you can sort of do a systems check to see, like, what is it that I'm taking in? What is it that I'm consuming? And maybe, you know, inquire about, well, what is the source of my pleasure in watching this, that, or the other thing, or listening to it, or reading it?
Dr. Ethan Stoneman, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Public Address here at Hillsdale College. His research paper, Real Cruelty, Voyeurism and Extrajuridical Punishment in True Crime Documentaries. Dr. Stoneman, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Larry Arn talking about the Iron Curtain speech from Winston Churchill. Mary Eberstadt on the fury of the fatherless and the root causes of the recent violent riots and protests across the country. And Ethan Stoneman talking about true crime documentaries. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The Turtle Bay Spring Plant Sale has been extended. You can now enjoy discounts at the nursery all April long. We grow California native and climate acclimated plants from around the world, primed to grow strong and healthy right in your own backyard. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping our veterans hospital, or folding laundry, we have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to a North State with no more homeless pets.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at RiverviewGolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Meet Stella the Seahorse and her companions in Washed Ashore, Art to Save the Sea, now on display at Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Delightful and shocking, this indoor-outdoor exhibition highlights the perils of plastic pollution. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
put you, the writer, behind the wheel of the squad car, walking a beat, investigating crime scenes, and sitting behind a desk writing reports. So, put on your Sam Brown belt, strap on your vest, and let's go experience what cops do and learn why they do it. Patrick O'Donnell.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Holt.
And I'm Lee Estes.
Continuing our series with people with advanced skills, we are getting into law enforcement, a very common character in a lot of genres. So our guest today is Patrick O'Donnell. Welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So we know you wrote this opening quote, and that came from your book, Cops and Writers. How long have you been in law enforcement?
Okay. I just retired February 21st of this year from law enforcement. I retired as a police sergeant in the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after 25 years of service.
Wow.
Presently 55 years of age, so that's about typical across the nation. To give your listeners some context, Milwaukee is a city of about 600,000 people. There's about 1,800 law enforcement sworn members, which means they have arrest powers. And out of that 1,800, there was about 200 sergeants. I was one of them. I was a street sergeant, so I spent all of my career on the streets.
You wrote a book called Cops and Writers. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The first book is Cops and Writers, From the Academy to the Streets. I'm an independently published author. That was the fourth book that I've written. I was in the middle of the second post-apocalyptic book, and I was getting deeper and deeper into the weeds in self-publishing and going to conferences, getting to know people, and inevitably it's always, what do you do for a living? What's your day job? And I tell them, and they had just a plethora of questions. And I was like, yeah, you should really just start consulting with authors, and you should be writing books about this. So I scrapped the post-apocalyptic book, and I wrote this book. I also started a Facebook group to see if there was interest in it before I invested too much time or money into this project. And the results were fantastic. People were very open to it. I've helped a lot of writers kind of write their way through maybe some plot holes or just does that really happen kind of questions. So now I just sent off the second book in this Cops and Writers series, and that's going to be Crime Scenes and Investigations. And hopefully that'll be out in September. That's what I'm shooting for.
Oh, that is awesome. And let me just say, I am part of this Facebook group, and it is fantastic.
Well, I'm glad. That makes me very happy.
So what do you see that really works well and drives you up the wall?
Most of it doesn't work well, and most of it does drive you up a wall. My wife loves shows like, you know, Hawaii Five-O, you know, all the different spin-offs of CSI. And most of them are far, far from reality. You know, it's entertainment. I guess it's not very exciting to watch a cop or a detective do 8 hours or 10 hours worth of reports after a 5-minute chase. And that's the reality of it. There was one TV show that I thought was pretty spot on, and that was Southland. What I liked about that show was it got the gallows sense of humor. It got the banter between the cops. And it really showed the human side of things that a lot of TV shows and movies, you know, it seems like it's one extreme or another. Some of the things that really drives me crazy is most of police work that's done, that's exciting, quote unquote, is done by police officers on the street. It's not detectives. Detectives usually show up after the fact. This is funny. We tease them sometimes. We used to call them third responders. But no, you decide to show up. That's nice. But the breaking down the doors, the car chases, the stuff that gets notoriety and the highest amount of liability are the first responders, the cops on the street. Say like a homicide detective. You see that a lot on TV and in movies. They respond when there's somebody that just committed a homicide. Sometimes that could be a half an hour to an hour after the police officers show up on the scene. Then a sergeant's going to show up on the scene. That's what I did. And you quickly try to maintain control of the crime scene. You set up a perimeter. That's when the yellow tape goes up that everybody is familiar with.
If there is one concept that you could make everyone understand.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.